Yeah, that was the Kansas State Fair, where every year through the 1920s, there would be a finest family competition to determine, this was not just in Kansas, but Kansas was one of the leaders, to find the people that were eugenically the best. And invariably, these eugenically superior families were blonde and blue-eyed, and they looked like they could have come out of a cornflakes ad.
That's Daniel Okrent, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Daniel Okrent was the first public editor of the New York Times, editor-at-large of Time, Inc., and managing editor of Life magazine. His previous books include the New York Times bestselling Last Call and Great Fortune, which was a finalist for the 2004 Pulitzer Prize in History. He joins us to talk about his latest book, The Guarded Gate: Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Give us a brief overview of this book. What are readers going to find here?
This is the story of the most restrictive and, one could say, discriminatory immigration law in American history, passed in 1924, that was in effect for more than 40 years, and how the bogus junk science of eugenics was used specifically to keep Eastern and Southern Europeans out of the country. It did so successfully, and it did so much to the, shame of the country.
You spotlight Francis Galton as the person who gave life to eugenics. Tell us about him.
Galton was a first cousin of Charles Darwin's. He was a very wealthy gentleman scientist. He accomplished a great deal of work of real scientific value in statistics and fingerprinting, a variety of other things. But he came up with this notion that the quality of the English population could be improved by what he called eugenic marriage, where one would choose the people with the finest genetic quality by his measure. They would be put into arranged marriages by the state. These marriages would be conducted en masse, as many as 5,000 at a time in Westminster Abbey, with Queen Victoria presiding over it. And then each of these couples would be paid an annual stipend, so they didn't have to get regular jobs. They could just get busy reproducing better Britons. And this kind of loony idea leapt across the Atlantic around 1900, and then was picked up, modified, and eventually distorted in a very ugly way by some American scientists.
Put this in perspective for me. I mean, what was happening in America at that time to give rise to politicians and other prominent people embracing eugenics as a way of justifying their anti-immigrant goals?
Well, you nailed it. The large immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe, from Poland, from the Russian Empire, from Italy, from Greece, begins in the late 1880s. In the middle of the 1890s, there begins a very strong movement led by largely Boston progressive aristocratic politicians, Henry Cabot Lodge chief among them, to stop the immigration from those countries because they thought it was ruining the American bloodstock, to use their term. And for 20 years, they fought very hard in Congress, passed legislation that would restrict immigration from both countries four times that they were vetoed by presidents. And each time the president who did the vetoing said, this is discriminatory. This works against the principles of the American democracy where everybody's created equal. And then they came up with this notion in 1916 with the publication of a book called The Passing of the Great Race, that instead of it being discriminatory, it was scientific. And they said that now that science has proven that these people are inferior, they need to be kept out of the country. So it moved from being openly discriminatory to being blessed with this aura of bogus science.
And I was surprised to read that there were a number of prominent people who you saw sort of progressive in other ways that embraced this. For example, Margaret Sanger.
Yeah, she's one of the leading figures that would surprise people, but hardly alone. I mean, in fact, there was something very appropriate to the progressive notion, and I'm using progressive in the term the way it was used back in the early 20th century with eugenics, which is to say the progressives believed one could use the power of the state to improve the nature of the country and the life of Americans. They believed greatly in the application of science to be able to do this. Now, picking up this particular science was a distortion of even their fondest ideals, but one man who was very prominent, this was a very wealthy philanthropist and activist, considered himself a socialist in Boston, named Joseph Lee. And basically, he believed that these were inferior people. They needed to be kept out of the country. Yet at the same time, once they were here, he paid for their educations because he believed he had to turn them into worthwhile citizens. So there wasn't, it was consistent to a degree with his view of what the progressive cause called for.
I was curious about Margaret Sanger, though. What do you think her rationale was for?
Well, there are a couple things apply in Sanger. First of all, she would make an alliance with anybody who supported her cause. And if you stop to think about it, the idea of eugenics is very, it's related, maybe it's a first cousin of birth control, because it's planned breeding. Now, it's a very different goal than what we think is birth control today, but it was the notion that one could impose rules, laws, or principles into the private lives of people who were choosing or choosing not to have children. Secondarily, Sanger would make an alliance with anybody who agreed with her. She was like many zealots, and I say this as somebody who basically is a supporter of what Sanger believed, that she, you know, if she saw somebody who could help her, she would find a way to help that person back. So you find her saying in the 1920s that we have to bring birth control to the slums, the Italian slums of New York, because look at how these people are living. They're living in squalor. They don't have jobs. The children are undernourished. So this was something that played right into the hands of those who wanted to have active discrimination against Italians. So they made a neat, if unlikely, pairing.
Were there people in the United States who were working against this eugenics movement? What kind of opposition was there?
There was an opposition both in the scientific community and the political community, but it was, in the case of the most ardent and would have been the most effective opponent of the great anthropologist Franz Boas, he was sort of disarmed by the opposition when the opposition said, well, of course he doesn't believe in this. He's a Jew himself, so how can we trust him? Not long after that, in 1921, an article appears, of all places, Good Housekeeping magazine, in which Calvin Coolidge says, now that science has proven that these people are inferior, we must find a way to legally keep them out of the country. And so they brushed right past the opposition of people like Boas and other politicians who saw a more multifarious and multicultural America as an ideal.
So as you mentioned at the beginning of our interview, this was an idea that came over from England to the U.S., but it also found its way to Germany.
Right, and that's when the eugenics movement begins to come to an end with the rise of Hitler, because the American institutions, scientific institutions and philanthropies like the Carnegie Institute of Washington, the American Museum of Natural History, Princeton University, Stanford, they suddenly realize, oh my God, look what we've done. Somebody has taken these ideas, these core ideas, that there is a qualitative difference in not just the intelligence, but the morality, is the term they use, between different ethnic groups. And they've taken these ideas from these American scientists. And in fact, Hitler himself had read some of these books, and he often invoked what the American eugenicists had said. And at the end of the war, when there was the Nuremberg doctors' trials, one of the doctors defended himself by saying, well, you're accusing us of imposing these eugenic principles. Well, in fact, your own scientists, your own universities were putting this forward on their own. And as I write in the book, we've heard many times about the Nazi race scientists saying we were only following orders. But in fact, to a degree, they were following Americans.
One of the things that surprised me is how long this eugenics movement had an influence. You write in the book about it had an impact on immigration from 1924 all the way up to 1965. So why do you think its influence lasted so long?
Well, the eugenics itself only lasts into the 30s. But once the law is in place, there was a lot of American support, as there is today, for cutting immigration generally and from specific countries. It does not bring out the best of us when we begin to turn our immigration policies restrictive, not on the basis of the quality of the individual who wishes to come in, but on the quality of the ethnic group that the individual comes from. So these laws only begin to change. They first begin to change in World War II when the Chinese, the Chiang Kai-shek Chinese, are our allies in the war. So suddenly Chinese who had been excluded since 1882 were now welcomed into the country. And then during the 1950s, the countries behind the Iron Curtain were seen as being oppressed by the Soviet Union. We wanted those people to be able to immigrate for political reasons. And as it happened, they were from the same ethnic groups that had been excluded. And then finally in 1965, in conjunction with the U.S. Civil Rights Movement, the idea of opening the gates irrespective of national origin takes hold, and Lyndon Johnson signs that bill in 1965.
Well, as you mentioned a moment ago, we really do still have anti-immigrant sentiment going on here in the United States. So what do you think we can learn from history, looking back on this dark period of our history? What does it say to us today?
Well, it tells us there are consequences to immigration policies that are based on ethnicity, that we don't know what they're going to be. We don't know what the nature of politics and war abroad or of natural disaster or economic disaster. To make a distinction between people because of their race or their religion or their nationality is only to invite the possibility of catastrophe down the line. If we're choosing people as individuals, we don't have to worry quite so much about that notion of what could lead to genocide or its equivalents.
I want to draw your attention to the photo section of your book. There's a picture that comes from a fair in Kansas. I don't know exactly where the fair is, and I am talking to you from Kansas. And I was just curious if there's anything you could tell me about that photo.
Yeah, that was a Kansas State Fair, where every year through the 1920s, there would be a finest family competition to determine, this was not just in Kansas, but Kansas was one of the leaders, to find the people that were eugenically the best. And invariably, these eugenically superior families were blonde and blue-eyed, and they looked like they could have come out of a cornflakes ad. And the basis of these genetic determinations, these eugenic determinations, were utterly bogus. They had nothing to do with who the people were or genetic makeup was. It had to do with what somebody else's ideal of a genetic makeup would be. And as you know, as you see in the picture, you know, there's a sign that's showing the consequence of bringing in people from outside the country about the relative levels of literacy and illiteracy. They're much worse if they're coming from abroad. Negroes are much worse. Foreign-born, much worse. And it was a very effective propaganda movement.
Hmm. So the Kansas State Fair, that would have been in Hutchinson, Kansas. And what that brings me to is the realization that this wasn't just something that was happening at the higher levels of government that were making rules about immigration, but this was a view that was propagated all across the United States.
Very effectively. The notion, not necessarily having to do with directly with immigration, but the notion that one could make distinctions about the quality of an individual based on his or her racial, ethnic, nationality background, that became very, very popular. The Saturday Evening Post, which was the most powerful mass medium of the time, was a great advocate of it, pushed it for years and years and years. It was taught in universities across the nation, and it wasn't really until the rise of the Nazis that it was discredited.
This obviously is a history book, but beyond giving us a sense of history and a time and place of something that happened here in the United States, is there a greater takeaway for your readers today?
Mark Twain said history doesn't repeat itself, it only rhymes. And I think that we are in a rhyming period right now. The nature of our immigration debates aren't the same as what they were 40 years ago. I'm sorry, in this case, 100 years ago. But there are echoes, there are rhymes of what happened then, and I think that we need to heed them. And we need to see that there are consequences that have to do not just with what's happening today and whether a particular individual or family is coming to the country, but what the consequences will be for that individual and for our nation over the next several decades.
Well, Dan, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Daniel Okrent's book is The Guarded Gate: Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. You can sign up for the Conversations podcast on iTunes, and you'll also find us on Facebook. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.